for it to get ordered. Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the General Government Transportation Committee. It's Wednesday, March 21st, 2001. And at this time, what I'm going to do is I'm going to form a subcommittee of two, which is those of us who are here. And then with that, we will take comments and testimony on Senate Bill 88, Senate Bill 502, and Senate Bill 564, commonly referred to as the Truth in Driving Bills. And so with that, I'll open up this work group of two. Yes, and we'll have
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 88 eliminates the rural interstate speed limit, restores the basic speed rule with a maximum speed of 75 miles per hour for rural interstate highways. Senate Bill 502 increases the rural interstate highway speed limit to 75 miles per hour for automobiles and 70 miles per hour for motor trucks and passenger buses, and authorizes the Oregon Department of Transportation to increase or decrease speed limits on rural interstate highways if it determines that the newly established speed limit is safe with respect to road conditions. And Senate Bill 564 provides for default speed limits, which would apply in the absence of posted speed limits, for alleys, business districts, roads and public parks, roads and residence districts that are neither an arterial nor a collector highway, roads adjacent to school grounds when children are present or there is a flashing red sign present, interstate rural highways and all other roads not previously identified. And specifically, it increases the rural highway speed limit to 75 miles per hour and increases the miscellaneous or all other road speed limit to from 55 to 65 miles per hour and broadens the current statute, which applies the default speed limits to just urban areas so that it would be applied to both rural and urban areas. And the first testifier is Senator Randy Miller.
Randy Miller, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, State Senator Randy Miller, District 13, and I appreciate this opportunity to testify specifically on Senate Bill 502. I can make brief comments if you want on the others to the extent I understand the 488 in particular, but I wanted to concentrate on Senate Bill 502. And I tell you, and the Vice Chairman, that I come to you with almost as the senator from Kaiser this morning got some guilt off of his chest, I have some myself that I need to share with this committee. This morning, as I commuted to Salem, I set my cruise control at 66 miles per hour on I-5. I recognize that that constitutes a violation of the maximum speed limit. Perhaps I could argue it doesn't violate the basic rule, given it was a beautiful day and light traffic. But nonetheless, it does violate the basic or the maximum speed. And let me share with you, Mr. Chairman, that as I was proceeding, I did so in order to conduct a study of the progress that other motorists were making traveling south. And I'm here to tell you, Mr. Chairman, that I passed a number of trucks. I passed, I entered the freeway in Wilsonville. I exited near Kaiser, south of the Kaiser exit on the parkway. I passed zero cars, zero. I was passed by quite a few cars. I was in the center lane, I was passed on the right, and I was passed on the left. And I would suggest to you, Mr. Chairman, that the people who passed me, even though I was proceeding at 66 miles per hour, were proceeding in a safe fashion. And the point of this bill, and it is often suggested in the media, and I think what they do is they read the first line of the summary, which is a bit misleading in that it suggests that it increases rural interstate highway speed limit. Well, in effect, it will allow the number to be changed, but it does no such thing in reality. The essence of this bill is to allow the Department of Transportation to assess the different highways of this state and then post a number up to 75 miles per hour that seems to be a safe and reasonable speed for our travelers to proceed. And And I think that's an important distinction in that this does not try to suggest that there is one speed limit for all sections of our highway. One size does not fit all. Indeed, I would suggest to you, Mr. Chairman, this bill tells the Department of Transportation that before they would post any numbers up or down, consult with the state police, consult with highway safety groups, consult with local jurisdictions where you might have some traffic going through on 18, for instance, Grand Ronde, perhaps up near Welch's. Maybe you don't want to proceed at a higher rate of speed. I know it goes down to 45 after you've been 55 through places where there are some people trying to get onto the highway. I'm not here to dispute that as a sound safety approach to traversing, but what I am here to do is to suggest to you, Mr. Chairman, it is just it is not appropriate for us to have this artificially low limit, and I will advocate that it be raised on our freeways. I tell people all the time about how I spend a lot of time with my 15-year-old daughter, and pretty soon she's going to be behind the wheel herself, with not necessarily with me in the car, but I know right now on occasion she might look over at my odometer when we are on I-5 and say, "Gosh, Dad, how fast are you going?" And I might have to suggest that, "Wow, I've let it creep up to 66 again," or something of that kind. And she might say, "Well, gosh, you're a legislator. How come you're not following the laws that all of you smart folks write?" And I'll suggest to her, you know, I could say something like she gave to me with one of her friends who was ticketed recently, "Well, Courtney, I'm just simply going with the flow." Well, that's not too satisfactory. So what I'm here to suggest, Mr. Chairman, and all of us who are out there know this, that it's 80% of our drivers on I-5 who are routinely violating this particular law. In fact, they believe the average Portland to Salem is 71.5. So we can do one of two things. We can either really bring out a lot more enforcement, put saturation patrols if we believe that's the right thing to do and make sure nobody travels over 65, or we can recognize the fact that fatalities continue to decline on those particular stretches, and we can say that our citizens should not be branded as lawbreakers but as reasonable drivers, and we should have a number that reflects their reasonable behavior. I'm a native Oregonian, and I can recall driving on those freeways when the posted sign said 70. And in parts of this state, I-84 eastbound was 75. I think given the advances in automobile design, in safety features, seat belts, airbags, collapsible steering wheels, and all the rest, radial tires, better brakes, we can accommodate a higher speed and still have the same results. Fortunately, as you know, we have an advertising program in this state that suggests that things are different here. Well, they are. And this is one of those things where we are different. Only this state and Iowa have not raised their speed limits. This state and Iowa, west of the Mississippi, have not raised their speed limits since the federal government got out of our face and got rid of their federal maximum. I would suggest that we look at the evidence of the other states, which suggests that raising their speed limits did not cause havoc, did not increase the number of fatalities, has not proven to be unsafe or unwise. And the other contention I would have that has been fortunate to have time to study this is, you know, the usual refrain that if you raise this limit, people know that maybe you can get by going 5 or 6 over before you get the attention of law enforcement. The experience of the other states has been that people have found a comfortable, safe speed at which to travel, and they stay there. In states of California and Washington, the studies that I have seen indicate that the speeds may have increased up to 1 mile per hour more than they were prior to the limit being raised. And so I suggest to you, Mr. Chairman, that this bill be forwarded as it was in the last session. I hope it has your support. And I thank you very much for this opportunity to testify. The only thing I'd say briefly in 488 is that simply repeals the maximum itself. I believe it asserts, I'm not sure that it has this yielding or this process through the Department of Transportation, but when you do abandon maximum limits, whereas I think it would be it returns us to the old days of the basic rule. Quite clearly, it has some impact on law enforcement to the extent that people challenge those citations. Law enforcement needs to be off the streets into the courthouses to defend their actions, and we need to think about that impact for those who are still on the highways. So with that, I thank you, Mr. Chairman, for allowing me to testify, and be glad to answer any questions.
Oh, yes. Senator Mester.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Miller, pleasure to have you in our committee today.
Thank you.
I was taken by your comments about the guilt that you felt of going in excess of the speed limit. So do I understand you correct? Is that perhaps one of the motivations for this would be to help remove your guilt if we could raise the speed limit and take that cloud away from you?
That would be, obviously it would lift a burden, Senator Metzger, and I would probably not be alone in having that burden lifted. So I,
certainly a follow-up question.
Yes.
You notice, you said that you had, have you, I don't know if you do a lot of boating, Senator. Have you ever heard of the one-foot-itis syndrome for boat owners?
No.
Where they, once you get a 20-foot boat, then they have to get a 21-foot boat, and then after that they need a 22-foot boat. And I just noticed that you said you had set your, you had confessed in this public body that you had set your speed limit at 66 miles an hour, which was 1 foot in ex- 1 mile per hour in excess of the 65-mile-an-hour limit. Would it be reasonable to assume that if we had a 75-mile-an-hour limit, you would probably be setting that at 76 and miles an hour in order to just have that sense of doing something that maybe wasn't quite right?
Is that Randy Rebel Miller?
No, Mr. Chairman and Senator Metzger, I don't think that that would be my course of behavior, because what I've advocated here is finding a reasonable and safe speed in which to travel, and I think that somewhere in the 70-mile-per-hour range based on traffic conditions would be, in most cases, a reasonable, safe speed. I don't have a desire to always push beyond the prescribed maximum. I was simply, by this morning's demonstration, trying to reveal the traffic pattern that now exists and give the committee some added understanding if it wasn't already there.
One other question, Mr.
Sure.
On a more serious note, Senator, I did receive a few comments on this bill indicating that the way it was written, that the speeds could be set for trucks, commercial trucks, could be 5 miles an hour less than the automobile. We've maintained a 10-mile-an-hour spread between large trucks and passenger vehicles. Do you have any particular heartburn if we were to move forward with this that, you know, the trucks kind of maintain maybe a slightly less speed than the passenger vehicle as far as the maximum speed was concerned?
Mr. Chairman and Vice Chairman Metzger, I would suggest that I am, I probably haven't concluded as to what is the right speed for trucks. That could certainly be an appropriate discussion in front of the Department of Transportation. Frankly, I've heard from trucking interests that they suggest that speeds ought to be kept down. And then, as I related to you prior to this hearing, I was just happened to be on a radio interview program where callers could call in, and a trucker got on there who hauls goods in 11 western states and suggested that in a lot of the western states the speeds are identical, and it was his suggestion that we try to keep the flow of both trucks and cars at an even speed, and suggesting that disparity in speed is one of the great dangers out on the highway. So I don't mean to avoid concluding on your question, but I would certainly encourage this committee to take evidence from those who are out there who drive truck and who probably have a better response than I do.
Good non-answer there. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Years of practice.
Thank you, Senator. I'm continuing to learn from you.
Senator Miller, last session when we had this discussion, we had some interesting information presented to us. I believe the state police came in with some numbers. We asked a few questions relative to that, so I'll ask you the same question that we dealt with back then. We all recognize that the average person on Highway 5 is not going 65, but is doing 71 plus. And in fact, when you're out there, and if you're doing 71 plus, you find out that you're still being passed by an enormous number of cars. The point being is, though, is that when we looked at the accident and the fatality statistics per million miles driven or something like that, or whatever your factor of measurement was, we saw that the fatalities were going down. Did you do any research on that this time to see whether or not that has turned in a different direction?
I don't have fresh statistics. All I can say is in our brief look, we found no exception to that general proposition that fatalities continue to go down. As I said 2 years ago, I'm not here to advocate that we raise speeds to 100 miles an hour in order to eliminate all fatalities. But I am suggesting that the curve has been such that as speeds have gone up, and this was true, as you know, people routinely violated the rule when we had this federal maximum in place at 55. And in fact, the first year of the 55, I think, was one of the largest years of fatality that we've had for quite some time, because people were just not going to obey that. Didn't feel they should, didn't. Those who did, there was that great disparity. But as speeds have increased up to this comfortable level, where I'd say they are in probably most western states, around 70 to 72 in that neighborhood, fatalities have continued to decrease. And So I just think it's time for Oregon to take advantage of the learning provided by the other states and also, again, allow our citizens to drive knowing that their speeds are reasonable and also knowing that they're not breaking Oregon law. As a further example, not only the situation with my daughter, I had a son who, after his Marine service, did some years in law enforcement. I'm concerned about the public relations and the image of someone who is asked to enforce a law that Oregonians don't respect. Can you imagine? And I know this happens, and we all know it happens, when people, if they were cited for going 72 on a freeway, which they could be, and sometimes are, how do they feel about being singled out when their response is typically, I was going with the flow? And they are probably absolutely right, they were. But how do they feel about the officer who pulled them over and ticketed them? Not very good. And I don't want the officers to be in a situation where we have caused them to go out there, do their job, and arrest citizens for behavior that's safe and that and the law that is, again, routinely ignored. I just don't think that's good for them.
Senator, I've driven car and truck from one end of the state to the other, and one of the things that I notice is that when conditions change out on Highway 5, weather conditions, whether it's heavy rain or fog or whatever, people automatically, they'll drop from 71 plus. They'll come right back down to 50, 55, 45, whatever they believe is safe. And I watched, in fact, I believe I still have a copy of that in my office, a presentation, I think it was on ABC News, by Genevieve Giuliano. And she's the head of the planning department, I believe still is, at the University of Southern California. And in that piece, she talks about the fact that we all will make a decision relative to what we believe is a safe condition. And if the weather conditions change, if the road narrows, if we go into the Twilliger Curve, you could post 95 at the Twilliger Curve and we'd all slow down, okay? Particularly if we knew it. We knew the curve. So do you agree with that concept? I mean, do you see that happening when the weather conditions change where everyone seems to bring that back down to a reasonable speed?
I think most drivers are reasonable. And the reason we need to, however, still have enforcement out there is there are some who are not, who will not behave even under the best conditions, or who will be extraordinarily careless and reckless in the worst of conditions. Actually, the Twilliger Curves is a good example, because after we did have some history of accidents, that stretch was examined and the number was lowered to, I believe, 50 now through those curves. That makes sense. So I want to make sure this committee understands the advocacy here is not just always upward. It's to reflect reality and experience and what, again, a law that citizens would respect and obey, given the circumstances of that particular stretch of highway. And Mr. Chairman, you remind me of, you know, one of the great farces of all time was the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration mantra of speed kills. Well, you know, I guess I will stipulate that moving bodies are more likely to do damage to one another if they collide than stationary objects. I mean, when you think of the things that are included in the statistics that are brought forward to try to defeat this concept. NHTSA's own definition, speed-related, includes improper lane change. Well, you know, you could do that if you were barely moving. But speed to most people means excessive speed, too fast. That is not necessarily too fast, following too closely. Well, I suppose it could be too fast, but suppose you're going on a freeway and somebody's going 42 miles per hour in the left lane and you come up too fast. I guess you should have controlled your speed a little bit better, but maybe there's something to be said about someone impeding the flow. Inattention. That was one of their things for, you know, speed. Well, you can be inattentive at a slow speed and cause problems. Erratic speeds. You know, that can be up or down, too. And you can be going too fast, which isn't related to 75 on a freeway, on one of those days you described, whether it's foggy, whether it's icy in the winter here. You know, you may be going 20 miles per hour, and that could be too fast in some stretches. People have to, as you suggest, be reasonable, and I think most are, which is kind of the magic of the old basic rule,
mm-hmm.
reasonable for the circumstances, which is still contained in this proposal. It's the second part of the ticket, but I think it's but for the, again, the requirement of the law enforcement personnel that have to spend time in the courtroom arguing the ticket, that's probably the best standard of all, is whether or not you were driving reasonable given the conditions.
Senator, we thank you very much.
I thank you for your accommodation. Appreciate it.
We're going to bring another senator up here, and we'll find out that if he, whether or not he has been going 66 miles an hour on Highway 5.
Well, I don't want to make everybody vote based on their own current practices, although if they did, this bill would pass.
Well, that's it. And, you know, we've had a similar session like this recently with the ATV bill, where most of the farmer people that are on this committee all admitted that they had unknowingly been violating the law. And so we felt really good about being able to clarify that, and they could then operate legally.
Kumbaya.
Kumbaya.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator.
Senator Meyer, would you come on?
How do you follow that?
We think you will be able to handle it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Committee members, member. For the record, I am Lee Byer, State Senator from Lane County. And I would like to address you on Senate Bill 564, which is yet another speed limit bill. This one, actually, I had similar ones in past sessions, but this one specifically I introduced at the request of the Mapleton High School students, civics class there, which I went out and was working with a friend who's now a teacher, his former legislative assistant to former state representative Tony Federici, that now is into teaching, and he asked me to come out and talk to his class about civics and the legislative process. And I had commented to them that I would help them if they had some ideas that they would research and wanted to have introduced as legislation. This was one of four of them. It's probably one of the least controversial ones. The other one had to do with one of the other ones had to do with industrial hemp that I'm not here to talk about. Just, thanks a lot. It's a good thing I'm term limited. This bill specifically does a couple of things. One, it raises, based on the students' research, and they felt very strongly about this, the speed limits to a maximum of 75 on a freeway and 65 on a state highway, other state highways. And again, it's a maximum. It also, at the request, as I had the Legislative Council drafting this, DMV and I believe the state police had asked that we include some language that clarified the I forget the common law definition.
The basic rule.
Basic rule. So it addresses some of the concerns I had on that. I'm not going to go over what Senator Miller said before, but I'll tell you, as someone who spends 2 hours a day now on Interstate 5 between Eugene and the Capitol, and who spends a lot of time on the I-5 when we're not in legislative session and the roads in my business, that nobody's driving 65 out there. In fact, I will tell you point blank that I see a lot of state police officers, a lot of them that pass me, going over 70 miles an hour, so they're not going 65 either. One of the things that people forgot is when they built Interstate 5, they engineered it for a speed limit over 70 miles an hour.
And that's what it was for many years until we had the first energy crisis in the early 70s. So it's not a matter of even traffic engineers thinking that that particular road is not built to handle the speed. It was designed and built to handle that kind of a speed. Certainly there are some drivers who can't handle that, and as the chair was saying, there are some times that you shouldn't be going that fast, and there's sometimes when that makes sense to do that. I would tell you that at least between the interstate, the Sanium Highway off-ramp in Eugene, the average speed is about 73 miles an hour right now on that road, and there are many that are going faster than that in terms of cars, not necessarily trucks. So it's a common speed. The thing that strikes me the most, the part that I've always thought was most important in terms of government, as I've been involved in local government, state government, is laws should really be at a level that the majority of the people think is appropriate. And clearly the population believes that 65 is not the speed limit on an interstate highway. It's higher than that. Whether it should be 75, as the students I worked with suggested, or 70, I'm not sure. But I'll tell you that the it should be set at what most people are driving out there now. Simple as that. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'm glad that we could get some young people involved in the process.
Absolutely. Senator, if we work towards combining the bills and picking out, you know, the best points, are you comfortable with the idea that the discretion to actually move it up would be determined by ODOT and their analysis along with state police of that highway?
That's what my bill does.
Fantastic.
It sets the maximum unless otherwise posted, with the idea that ODOT has the expertise to know where that's not the right speed.
Senator Beyer, have you had a chance to look over Senator Miller's bill? He was just
I have not.
Because conceptually they're very similar, but I imagine there are some changes. But I gather from you that unless there's substantive changes, that your willingness to maybe work on combining those would be acceptable.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, I really don't care whose bill passes or which shape. I just think the intent of the bill is it makes sense.
Right.
To do that, and it's not a surprise to me that Senator Miller had one. We both had one last session, too. And I would point out, last time, Governor Kitzhaber had said he wouldn't approve of this unless we added more state police officers. We did that last time, although he proposed to cut them out in this budget. I think we're on the track to put some back on, so at least in the context of the governor's requirements, we met his initial requirements of adding more state police officers. My perception is there seems to be plenty, at least on the interstate. So I think the enforcement arm is there.
Well, Senator, I think you probably recognize there's a big effort to put those state police officers back into the budget. This, you know, part of the supplemental issue. I would hope that could you check with the governor's office to see if they would be agreeable to a similar position.
I could check, but I'm not sure that I'd get any different answer than you would, Senator.
All right.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you very much. Patrick, who do we have standing?
Yes, Mr. Chair, the next testifier is Troy Costales of the ODOT Safety Section.
Troy, we'll ask you to raise your right hand and tell us how fast you drove down here today.
Ms. Chairman, 65. Ms. Chairman, Vice Chairman Metzger, my name is Troy Costales. I'm the manager of the Transportation Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. And to make this easy, what you're receiving is actually all three of these bills combined into one, because the support documents behind each of these are the same, and so for efficiency's sake and cost savings, it didn't make sense to make 25 copies three times. All three of these bills attempt to and request to raise the rural interstate speed to 75 miles an hour. Senate Bill 564 has some other twists to it that I can bring up if you'd like, because there are subtle differences between all three of these bills, and they do make differences in how they're applied. Bottom line, Mr. Chairman, is that ODOT is opposed to higher speed limits for a variety of reasons, which you've heard over the past few sessions, and repeat a few of them now. Speed-related fatal crashes now exceed alcohol-related fatal crashes in the state of Oregon. Now, the last year's worth of records, it's now up to 56%. Alcohol-related was 39%. In any instance with increasing of speed, you're increasing the energy that's involved in a collision or a crash. You are increasing the closing speed on any object or obstacle in the way. You're also carrying very often that speed off of the rural interstate onto the attached roadways and highways. And in every one of those cases, the attached highway or county road in the rural areas is not built to carry that increased speed that the individual takes off of the main interstate with them. The past two presenters both talked about average speed on the rural interstate and brought up 71 miles an hour or 72 miles an hour as the average speed. That's incorrect. That is the 85th percentile speed. That means that 85% of the traffic is going 71 or less. So the average is going to be below 71. So you want to be careful because there is misuse of some of the information or mislabeling of that information to characterize as average, and it's not. It's 85% at that speed or below.
Troy, we get spun numbers constantly, but let me just ask you a question. When you guys established that number, were you taking into account what kind of weather it was on a beautiful sunny day? What would have been the average speed versus the rainy, heavy rainy day and the foggy day? Or was it just in general, an average speed taken because the counters were out there and we were able to measure it?
Mr. Chairman, there's two ways that the speed can be brought up in that. One is by recorders that are already in the asphalt, mm-hmm. and they're running 24 hours a day, right. every day of the year. And then there's also those where they'll go out specific times, either with speed measuring devices or potentially road tubes in order to calculate it on certain days. What I would like to do is, if you would turn to the attachment, and the very first one is a snapshot of center and western United States. I'd just like to present a couple things to you in reference, because quite often what happens in this debate, it's how does Oregon compare to the other states?
Sure, I need to share with you and everybody here that I have a brand new granddaughter. And I just
congratulations. Congratulations.
So I'll have to drive fast to get home.
I would say I'd rather have you get there safely.
Safely, okay.
She'll be there when you get there, whatever time you get there. On this chart, and I think there are extra copies on the slide table for those that want to follow along, we color-coded the first page just to give you an idea of those states that have rural interstate at 65. There are three of them in green. Those states that currently have 70 miles an hour, which there are in yellow, and there are seven. And then those states that are in red are relating to 75, and I believe that there's 12 of those states. In each of the states, in small print, and I'll take you to the next page, it'll be a little bit easier to read, but this is comparing, this is one of the things that came up during last session, was the conversation of you raised the speed in the states where they did raise the speed, there wasn't necessarily an immediate impact in the number of fatalities or crashes on those roads. This snapshot is taking the 3 years prior to when they changed their speed to the 3 years after, so it is much better information to do some comparison. We'll point out for you on the page where the colors are, you'll notice all three green states show that from the 3 years prior to 3 years after, they're showing fewer fatalities in their state. In the yellow states, which raised to 70, there are five of those states show an increase, which includes Washington. The two states that did show decreases are California and Minnesota. And on California, I can give you a little bit of information as to why there's a particular issue in their cases to the big decline. Every one of the red states have an increase, bottom line. Every one of the states that went to 75 saw an increase in their state in the number of fatalities that occurred. The first data page.
Was there any measurement on DMT? Obviously, like we've had a 60% increase in DMT. You have that.
Mr. Chairman, it's on the very next page. The first data table right behind the map. Again, breaking out the three states at 65, the seven states at 70, and those at 75. The third column in is giving you the overall fatality rate, which does take into consideration the number of miles traveled on the roads in those states for the 3 years prior to the change of their law to the 3 years after. The far right column is giving you an idea of what's happened in those states. For the three green states, you'll see that they had an average drop in their fatality rate of 13%. Things got better. For those states that were at 70, their rate dropped 4%. For those states that went to 75, their rates only dropped 1%. That's taking into consideration, Mr. Chairman, your question about the amount of travel on those roads compared to what's going on. I will point out, if you look just specifically to say, what about us on Oregon? We have one of the largest drops in the United States at 15% over those 6 years. The next page, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Vice Chairman, is the page that gets into the specific count of people. The three states that were at 60, that have stayed at 65 miles an hour, each state has averaged 93 lives saved from the 3 years prior to the speed change to the 3 years after. Those states that went to 70, they've seen an average of one life saved. And for those states that went to 75, they have seen an increase on average of 163 more deaths in each of those states for the 3 years after. This would be a good time, I think, to explain California. They are really the one that falls out of the pattern from all of these states. California sticks out funny compared to the others. Two main reasons. One, they have a huge California Highway Patrol that does nothing other than patrol the freeway system within the state of California. Plus, they've pushed and done a big effort on their safety belt law, and California Highway Patrol has taken on as one of their major emphasis to be out and around and to push. In fact, California has the highest safety belt use rate in the nation, in part for the last few years because California's pushed so heavy on raising their rate. Two parts of the reasons as to why they're so low and why they've seen a drop compared to the states around them that where they've seen increases. The last page in the packet, Mr. Chairman, is a public opinion question. Because this is an issue, it keeps coming up. One of the things that my office was asked is, what does the general public think? So as part of an overall public opinion poll that we do, we ask the question, do individuals favor or oppose raising the 65-mile-an-hour speed limit? The opposition has stayed at or about 60% over the last 5 years, the little graph up above. And I thought it would quite be interesting for you to see, what does it look by area of the state? How are citizens responding to the question, do you favor or oppose the speed limit? So it's just broken out for you just to see, to get an idea, because sometimes the claim is Central and Eastern Oregon absolutely must see this increase. Yet you're seeing, 57% of the central state in the polls indicating they don't want to see the increase. There are a couple interesting things about Centerville 564, depending upon if you'd like to know those things or not. We're going to cover those.
Sure. Yes.
Centerville 564 not only is requesting an increase in the rural interstate, is also asking and requesting an increase in the other highways in the state that are currently posted at 55. Those roadways, as far as if you were to look at in the state of Oregon, the various crash rates and fatal rates on interstate, urban and rural, and then highway systems, urban and rural, the rural highway systems have the worst crash record of any of the roads that are considered state roads. It's at raising the limit is asking for those to go even higher. And I will point out that all 14 of our safety corridors are on the rural highway system. And in most cases, there's been requests locally to lower the speed limits, as you've seen, Mr. Chairman, on Highway 18. Senator Metzger, I think it's U.S. 26 and the Canby 99E issue. What 564 is doing is saying, let's take those roads and raise them from 55 to 65. I would anticipate lots of calls and lots of knocks on our door to start establishing more and more and more safety corridors around the state to put speeds back or to do some other things because residents there don't want to see in their location the increases that go up. The other piece to 564 that is unique and different, and that is 564 is requesting and changing the link for a violation tracking program that DMV uses when a conviction comes through and the conviction for the speed citation is 15 miles an hour or greater above the limit, or it's speed and a fatal crash combined. That data is collected and is part of a requirement that states have the ability to track and have that information as a pre-requirement to receiving the Motor Carrier Safety Assistance Program money from USDOT and for one of the transportation, another transportation fund that comes into the Highway Division. Between those two programs, it's about $5.5 to $6 million. There's a piece of Senate Bill 564 that eliminates that violation tracking program, putting us in jeopardy of not receiving those two federal funds. So the different type of fiscal impact other than the signing and the investigative report that 564 by itself carries in it. Bottom line, Mr. Chairman, as I opened up, ODOT is opposed to the speed limit increases just because we would expect to see and have evidenced by other states an increase in the number of fatalities and injuries in the state if that is to occur.
For informative, Troy, thank you for combining those. You know how it is. We always want you to save money and get pavement out there. Yes. Question, yes, Senator Metzger.
Troy, would you please define what are in Oregon, what is considered a rural interstate highway?
Mr. Chairman, Vice Chairman Metzger, rural interstate in the state of Oregon are those areas that you typically right now would see signs posted at 65 miles an hour. They're going to be outside the designated urban growth boundary. So it could be I-5 and I-84.
Okay. So, like you mentioned, Camby 99E, that is not a rural interstate highway.
Chairman, Senator Metzger, that's correct. That's the secondary highway.
Right. So you say primarily those two main highways are rural and would be considered rural interstate, I-5 and I-84?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzger, that's correct. There is a small portion of 205 that is also currently posted at 65 as you first enter it going north.
Yeah. So we have basically three rural interstate highways. Okay, well then, I'd like to direct you then, because I'm very confused, on your data. Because you have, under your statistics of fatalities, you have rural interstate crash analysis. And you say Oregon, in posted 65, has averaged 501 deaths a year. So you're telling me, so I'm clear on this, that an I-84, I-5, and a portion of 205, there are 501 people killed every year on those three highways. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzger, that's incorrect. What we're telling is that's how many fatalities were in the state as a whole.
Not necessarily on the three rural interstate highways.
That's correct.
The reason I say that, Troy, is that this data really is worthless in there because that does not apply to the bills that have been introduced. You're talking about, you know, that we have posted 65, and since that fatalities have gone down from year 1995, but these fatalities are on 82nd Street. They're in Camby. They're in front of the casino. They have nothing to do with the rural interstate raising of the speed limit. So to be accurate, we would have to see what the fatalities were on those three highways. The difference between when they were 55 and 65, wouldn't that not then be a more accurate assessment of the change?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzger, that is an additional way to collect the data. To look at just the roads that were impacted from state to state, we can't get that information, yet we're requested to try and compare how are we looking compared to other states that have had this issue, both from the last two prior sessions. The Insurance Institute for Highway Safety did some research on just a handful of states, not Oregon, but a handful of states that raised their limits in 1997. On the rural interstates where the limits were increased, those states averaged 10% to 15% higher counts in fatalities on those specific roads in those handful of states. But it's not something that we're able to try and answer the questions that come up on comparing states because there's no data that's allowing us to go to look at all of them.
Well, I understand, but I'm talking about just comparing within our own state is what has been the effect of raising speed limits on the three rural interstate highways, because certainly we have some serious problems, and as you mentioned, in my area, which is a safety corridor, Senator George has probably the two most notable safety corridors in our two districts, but they are unrelated except for the one bill, 564. The other two bills that talk about raising the rate on rural interstate highways, this information is not germane to that. What would be germane would be, and I know the Oregon Department of Transportation has this data, would be the crash and the fatality incidents data on those three highways, as we have seen a change in the speed posting, so that we can evaluate whether has there had any significant impact on that. The fact that our fatalities have gone down statewide, which is excellent, can reflect a lot of things. It can reflect, you know, better local law enforcement, better signage within communities, you know, better traffic flow in urban areas, but may not have anything germane at all to I-84, I-5, or a small portion of 205. And that's the only point, is that I don't know that other than finding the information valuable on a statewide basis, that it is particularly applicable to Senate Bill 88 or Senate Bill 502. But I would love to see that data. I would love to see what would have, what was the change from 55 miles an hour to 65, and to see and the speed related, and see what was changed as a result of that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzger, we'll go back and look. I do have some slides that are 92 through 1999, but it's not going back far enough to catch the 55-65 change.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Troy, if you could get that for us. Also, I was just thinking about some numbers, you know, when the governor did the growth study 2 years ago, we had, you know, 59% DMT increase and 20% population growth. And my estimate would be that the bulk of that DMT occurred on these interstates, you know, primarily, particularly if you threw 205 in there. And if that's the case, with this massive increase in the amount of traffic on the road, at the same time, we went from a 55 to a 65. Track those numbers for me and let me know when we went up. My understanding is the accident rate per 1,000 or million, whatever miles you measure, actually headed downward. Is that correct? Is that your recollection?
Mr. Chairman, in looking at just the piece from 92 to 99 that I have a copy of here, the rural interstate, which is the three that we're speaking of, for the fatality rate, has been between, it hovered around 1.00, the rate. It dipped in 1999 down to below 0.50. It had a dramatic drop from 98 to 99, but from 92 to 98 it stayed relatively flat. For the rural interstate crash rate, it has also stayed relatively flat from 92 to 99. With only 1 year really dropping below any of the rest, it's been around 0.30. But we'll go back farther in time and pull both those together to give to you not only the rate, but overall what's happened with the VMT, because that's what we have to use to create the rates.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Patrick, who signed up next?
And Mr. Chair, the next person signed up to testify is Lisa Millett.
Good afternoon, Chair George and members, our member of the committee. I'm Lisa Millett, and I'm the manager for injury prevention and epidemiology at the Oregon Health Division. And I'm here to provide information regarding concerns OHD has about Senate Bill 88, and the remarks that I'll give also apply to 502 and 564. I did have some testimony prepared, but as I was sitting there, I found some errors in it, and I'm not going to pass it out. We'll correct them and get back to you.
I tell you what, if you would like to hold that, obviously we're going to see if there's any interest in combining the bills, and maybe we could hear it then. You could do the correction, because I have some bills I'd like to get to.
That would be fine.
It doesn't look like I have a quorum, but as soon as I put out a call, I'll get them here. Would you mind doing that?
I wouldn't mind at all. Thank you very much, Chair.
Can you kind of just green out for us what you would be your main points, your concerns right now? Maybe we could use that and try.
The main points are three, Chairman George. Speed kills. The second point is increased speed has an increased cost in terms of cost of medical care, cost for crashes, for insurance, cost to families in terms of loss, cost and disabilities. Increased speeds, increase the types of injuries that are and the disability associated with them. Also, the third point is that Oregonians oppose increasing speeds. That would be all I'd say.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you for that. Patrick, who signed up next?
Yes, I apologize in advance if I mispronounced the name, but it appears to be Mr. Jim Botwinis. Botwinis.
Police have arrived.
Yes, welcome, sir.
Chair, Senator Metzger. My name is Jim Botwinis. I'm the president of the Oregon State Police Officers Association. We didn't put, you'll notice on our sign-up, basically an oppose or an opposition to any one of those bills, because there's actually three other bills on the House side that are speed-related,
mm-hmm.
and we have been working with the House Speaker on one of his bills concerning raising the speed limit. My sole purpose here really is to kind of give you a hit from the survey we did with the troopers and what their feelings were about raising the speed limit and their concerns if we did this, some of the other concerns they had. The polling we did was that, yes, the speed limit should be increased, and they had no problem with it being increased on rurals and secondaries. They believe that there should be, when it comes to passenger cars versus trucks, transport vehicles, there should be that differential, no clear cut whether it should be 5 or 10 difference, but there should be a difference between passenger cars and the bigger rigs. No clear cut on whether it should be 70 or 75. It was kind of evenly split between 70 and 75. The real concern comes that Oregon only has a maximum speed limit on rural interstate highways. Everything else is violation of the basic rule. Senator George, I'll give you an example because of the safety corridor in your neck of the woods and that being a pretty treacherous highway, 1822. We have a trooper, a resident trooper who's assigned in Polk County. If he writes a traffic citation to somebody doing 70 miles an hour on 18 or 22 in Polk County and goes to court with that, that person will generally be found not guilty. If he goes to Yamhill County, he knows he can write for 65 and will be able to convict that person. That is kind of a problematic thing to me in the court system, and with all due respect to the judges, relying upon a judge to determine whether a person's speed was greater than reasonable and prudent based on the highway and the conditions, et cetera, et cetera. Highway 1822 is posted 55, and for all intents and purposes, there's probably little reason to exceed that posted speed limit because of it being a safety corridor highway. So the trooper's concern is that if we're going to raise speed limits, they want to see everything a maximum speed limit. The violation of the basic rule basically becomes a secondary factor in determining whether they should be cited for something that would raise the elevation of the traffic offense and maybe the coinciding fine that goes with that. They don't think that everything needs to be posted 70 or posted 75. There should be some discretion about where those speeds should be based upon engineering, based upon traffic crashes, based upon conversations with law enforcement organizations, traffic safety organizations, the Department of Transportation, potentially even EMS, emergency services, and what is their response time to be able to get to a particular accident scene. You know, is it short? Is it a really long period of time? Because we all kind of know about the golden hour and being able to get the service provided to you, medical service provided to you. And possibly we look at a sunset clause. If we're looking at increasing the speed, that would create an automatic review. Did this, in fact, do what was thought that was going to happen? We were going to increase traffic fatalities. We were going to increase serious injury accidents. And if it did, then maybe the bill, maybe we revert back to where we are today or to something similar to what we have today. That is principally what I wanted to outline at this point. I'd be happy to answer any questions if I can.
Senator Metzger.
Jim, would you explain for me again, when you're talking about Polk County, the 70 mile versus the 65, it seems like you're indicating that 70 mile an hour violation was a violation of the basic speed. Is that it? And the 65 put it into a different category. Would you just clarify that a little bit for me?
Senator George, Senator Metzger, let's say, for example, the trooper is Keith Miller, and let's say that he stops a person on 18 or 22 for doing 70 miles an hour, and he stops that motorist. He will issue
55.
Right, so in the 55 right. zone. He would issue a citation for 70 miles an hour in a 55, violation of the basic rule, not exceeding the maximum speed because we have no exceeding the maximum speed on secondaries.
Mm-hmm.
If that person challenges that citation in Polk County, the judges there will not find that person guilty of traveling 70 miles an hour and a posted 55 mile an hour as being a violation of the basic rule, even though it's a safety corridor, even though we know we have high traffic crash rates on 1822. Yet, if he goes into Yamhill County, he knows that that same motorist that he stopped and wrote for 70 for violation of the basic rule in Polk County, he could write that same motorist for 65 miles an hour in Yamhill County and convict that person for violation of the basic rule in Yamhill County.
So you're saying the judicial discretion allowed under the law has allowed that discretion to be utilized differently?
Yes, sir.
Would you, Jim, just throwing this out, we're talking about safety corridors, which Senator George and I are both very familiar with in our areas, and I don't know what you've been working on with the speaker, but just to address that particular problem that you've mentioned, would there be some value, or would you be supportive of any type of language that that there would be a more severe violation, or that there was a definite ceiling, et cetera, for a safety corridor? And so, in other words, there was no wiggle room for any court on in those areas. If we try to differentiate those differently, perhaps than some other highways.
Senator Metzger, Mr. Chair, the troopers' comfort level seems to be with when we have a speed posted and people see a speed sign, the people should realize that's what the speed limit is for the designated highway that they're traveling on. We shouldn't be in this mindset that if they travel on an interstate and they see the sign, they, oh, okay, that's a maximum speed, and if I go over that, I could get a citation for going over that. But if I'm traveling on a secondary, if I know the court systems, I could squeak out 10 or 12 or 15 and still not get convicted doing that.
So it's a difference, you say, in the law for the secondary roads and the interstate highways?
Correct.
So just to summarize, as I understand it, then, that the troopers are not opposed to raising the limits, and some cases may see them as being appropriate to be raised, but you want to be very clear that there is a ceiling here that is a violation in excess of that ceiling.
Yes, sir, that is correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Great. I think those are reasonable. Any idea why we didn't deal with this issue before? I hate to admit that this is news to me. That we did not have posted wasn't the speed limit.
Mr. Chair, maybe it was just an oversight when the statute was revised. It was just an oversight that we made all non-rule speeds violation of the basic rule only as an enforcement mechanism.
Okay. Appreciate that. We want to hear more about this issue as we go forward on these. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's it. Is there anyone else who want to testify relative to the three bills on speed? If not, I'm going to close the small committee here, hearing on Senate Bill 88, 502, and 564. And at this time, what I'm going to do, I'm going to have to maintain our subcommittee group status. And at this time, I'd like to announce that if any of you were here relative to the Short Line Credit Premium Fund, that will be heard next Tuesday. And we're going to round up our members, we'll open up this committee, a small committee group, dealing with Senate Bill 47.
Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 47 confers on the Department of Consumer and Business Services the authority to set standards for the design of signs and parking spaces for disabled person parking. It limits program placard issuance to programs provided by health care facilities and school districts. It increases penalties for violations of disabled person parking laws. It requires holder of disabled parking permit to pay parking meter fees and comply with relevant time restrictions in public parking zones. It modifies disabled person parking permit fee schedule. Requires holder of out-of-state disabled person parking permit who relocates to Oregon to obtain an Oregon permit. Creates the offense of the use of invalid disabled person parking permit and punishes the offense by a maximum fine of $600. There is a -3 amendment that we'll be considering here today, and what the -3 amendment does with regard to the original bill is it deletes the reference to the Department of Business and Consumer Services and does not authorize the department to set standards for the design of signs and parking spaces for disabled person parking. It also deletes the limitation of program placard issuance to programs provided by health care facilities and school districts. It deletes the requirement of the holder of the disabled person parking permit to pay parking meter fees and comply with relevant time restrictions in public parking zones, and it reinstates the current disabled parking permit fee schedule. And the first person signed up to testify is Ellie Jenny.
Oh, I changed my mind. I can't believe the minimum. I'm not concerned now.
Okay. Okay. Ellie,
my understanding is that the dash threes is what we all thought we'd agree to that day, and you're happy with those?
Oh, yeah. I didn't see
them. All right. Well, good. We try to carry out the wishes of the people that tell us. Thank you.
Senator, the next two people signed up to testify are Susan Snyder of the City of Portland and Andrea Fogue, the League of Oregon Cities.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair. Susan Schneider with the City of Portland, Government Relations. We support the Dash 3 amendments. They reflect the issues that we agreed on with the Oregon Association of Agencies for Aging. I think it's the correct term. Jacqueline Zimmer's group. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger. Andrea Fogue with the League of Oregon Cities, and we also support the Dash 3 amendment.
Yes, he's working on it right now. Senator Metzger, would you please ask questions? So
I am. In fact, I was. I was just going to do that. Tell me, what you think now with these revisions, how this will improve the situation from your standpoint now. Because I think it was clearly articulated to me, we do have a problem.
That's right.
And I don't think there's any doubt we need to solve this. How will this bill now with the amendments, do you believe will help mitigate the problems that you have identified?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, Susan Schneider, City of Portland, it will take care of some of the problem that was identified over the interim by the work group, and that was the issues of the fines and also of how folk who come into the state are treated. And the other issues related to whether people should pay or whether they should be there all day, is one you heard a lot of testimony about, and I don't think any of us have a good answer for that right now, and we would like to spend some more time on that after this session is over and see if there are either technological things we can apply to that to make that better, or if there are in fact changes that need to be made that we can reach a consensus on. So it's a limited but an improvement on the current situation, we believe.
Well, and we will have a chance, too, if we get this through, to test to see whether or not the threat of additional fines is going to reduce the abuse. And that seemed to be, the one thing that brought us all together was the idea that, first of all, let's not punish the people who are disabled, but secondly, let's really hit the people who are abusing this privilege. I think that's really important that we've done that. Senator, I think you had another question, didn't you?
So I was waiting for her response to the same question.
Chair George, Senator Metzger, we also agree that it's a step in the right direction, but think that there's much work that still needs to be done on this issue, and we'd like to continue that work.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I just want to say for the public record, since I was one of the really chastised some of these people about the enforcement, because I think that is a real key. It's clear, and I think it's clear by the investigative work that's been done not only by the Oregonian but by some of the municipalities involved, that we have a huge abuse problem here. I will say that some of those abuses are probably likely by those people with some of those permits who have perhaps carelessly allow other members to use them without the threat of any severe penalty. And it is an issue, I think, that needs to be rectified. And I know the Department of Transportation is doing a better job with technology of trying to find these culprits through making better parking stickers. And I know nobody likes to change those, but I think at some point we're going to have to change them and require everybody to get new ones. Once we find those stickers that can help us identify the correct users of those. Certainly those, and I realize this may take some resources, but certainly those who are really abusing that issue because they just don't want to pay, like every other citizen, to use public facilities, to the extent that we can crack down on those people and make them tell us this is not appropriate. I think access is critical for this, and I want to make it very clear. I do not agree, and I will say, you know, for anybody in this room, I do not agree just because you have a disabled parking permit that you should pay for free. I don't think it's, I don't think it should be a charity issue. It's an issue of access, and those who are disabled need to have access. That is the real key issue, and I realize there is some impact there, but the people who need that access should not be inhibited by the fact that so many people are abusing that they can't get to that access, or it creates a bubble of problems for business and everyone else. And I think there is more work to be done on that, because we have a wide variety of people who utilize those placards, and some have greater needs than others. And it's difficult to kind of define that differently with the placard. But I do believe if we get what seems to be 97-98% of the abuse, if we could make any significant move in that, and hopefully this bill at least will be a start in the fines to get that abuse down, then again the boil has been lanced a little bit. And people who need that access will have greater access, and those who see abuse of the system from the business standpoint will not feel as that they're being overrun by this abuse. And I would encourage the city, particularly the city of Portland, to utilize the new fine structure as much as possible, if for nothing else, Mr. Chair, to really focus on those individuals who are abusing the program, because it affects the truly disabled who need that access. And I think the message will be loud and clear if, in fact, they realize that we mean business and the courts make sure we mean business. So that's my little speech. But I just want you to say that it is a problem, and it's not just for the disabled. It's a problem for everyone, and those who really are disabled are the biggest losers if we don't have a program that works, because we will continue wanting to change system that could negatively impact them. So I've given my speech, and are we any closer to giving anybody else in this room?
Well, I think our subcommittee will go hear another bill right now, and then we'll reopen in just a few minutes when we get a quorum. So I'm going to thank you two very much, and thanks everyone.
And thanks all you.
Gave us the input on this.
Right,
I think this is at least a baby step, but a good step. Okay, and boy, there came that baby issue again. I think he wants to go see this grandkid. So I'm going to close that subcommittee hearing on Senate Bill 47, and I will open up a subcommittee hearing on Senate Bill 701. Patrick, tell us about the concept here. I guess I should do that. It's my bill.
Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 701 requires the Oregon Department of Transportation to use cost-benefit analysis in ranking and selecting projects for the statewide transportation improvement program. It details some of the variables that must be included in the analysis and declares an emergency, making measures effective on passage. The Statewide Transportation Improvement Program represents Oregon's capital improvement plan for transportation. It covers a 4-year time period and is updated every 2 years. Projects currently in the STIP are selected based on criteria set forth under the Intermodal Surface Transportation Efficiency Act of 1991, or ICE-T and T21. Analysis conducted by ODOT staff using the agency's management systems and input provided by ODOT regions, ODOT area managers, and local government partners, transportation stakeholders, and the public. There is a no revenue impact issued for this bill. There is a fiscal impact of $729,800 during the 2001-2003 time period and $632,800 during the 2003-2005 time period. And the first person signed up to testify is Mr. Mike Marsh of ODOT.
Mike, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mike Marsh from the Department of Transportation. Patrick already went through the rendition of what the bill does. I think I'll lead off just by saying I think the chair knows that I'm as numbers-oriented as anybody, and I like to view myself as a person that focuses on fact-based decision-making as well as on return on investment, and that cost-benefit analysis can play an important role in making sure you're doing that type of evaluation. It also can bring a dimension of economic objectivity to whatever process is being used, as well as the fact that ODOT has had experience in doing this kind of work in both the bridge management system as well as pavement management and other areas. The concern that we have about the bill is that it implies that cost-benefit analysis alone is to make the decision, and our concern about that is that there are some shortcomings about cost-benefit analysis alone in making that decision, as well as it's not complete in terms of all the different factors that need to be included, some of which Patrick discussed. ODOT's programs currently work to preserve the existing infrastructure as well as deal with modernization. And I wanted to mention that on those elements that deal with current infrastructure, We work through life cycle costing approaches, which are a cost-benefit analysis or a form of cost-benefit analysis, and do that mainly to focus on the system itself. And we also have the process of looking at modernization projects where we look at the benefits of to the user as well as to the infrastructure itself. This makes a single cost-benefit analysis approach kind of difficult to do. You have certain kinds of work that you're looking at, whether it's pavement or bridge or looking at modernization projects. Each one of those have a lot of different factors that are involved in cost-benefit analysis and the proposed safety countermeasures that are necessary in order to deal with the effectiveness of a particular option. We try to get at the point of those with the highest payback being the ones that we incorporate into the decision process. For safety alone projects, we select a feature that is based on cost-benefit analysis but also looks at the most serious crash history as well as the safety priority indexing system, which shows the accident history by mile point within the system. And again, these types of benefits are different than those derived from preservation or modernization projects. So we have safety, we have preservation, we have modernization, each one approaching it a little bit differently using cost-benefit analysis, but sometimes difficult to totally throw all those numbers into a bin and come back with a final answer to make the decision. Even within modernization, there are some issues about using cost-benefit analysis alone. Those relate to the cost-effectiveness and economic development variables that are not the only ones that would be considered. There are significantly a high number of other ones, including land use considerations, as well as integrating the modes, dealing with community support, accessibility. All those are issues that need to be looked at. Quantifying these is very difficult. Weighting the process is subjective, depending on who's doing the weighting, and if that's the only method of making the decision, there can be a lot of subject to interpretation decisions made, and not addressing them would be also inaccurate from an economic perspective.
Mike?
Sir.
Before you go ahead, when we drafted 701, obviously because of the fact that it's 701, it was fairly late in the drafting process, and what we asked for was for a rough draft, just to get the concept out here. So what I would ask if you could, as you're going through this, because we have a study, Joan Plank provided this for us, you know, where in which ODOT just recently studied this issue. And so if you could make suggestions that might be applicable to what might be done and help us to determine whether or not utilizing some of the recommendations here that this might in fact evolve to be a complete bill, because right now it is just a framework.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I can give that a shot. The first thing is cost-benefit analysis is a tool, and I guess with the Chair's comments, I'll go to the last line of my testimony because I think that's the most important piece as we look at how this bill is structured. That's where I indicate that we use cost-benefit analysis as a critical input to decisions, but not as the decision. So cost-benefit analysis is something that we need to be doing and are doing, but we want to be careful not to be dictating that it would occur in every single case. I think just to talk through the issue with the chair here a moment, there are some cases where there's a preservation project or even a modernization project. The safety issues may dictate that something obviously needs to be done. We don't want to go through what those of us who have dealt with numbers in the past might call analysis or paralysis by analysis, where you go in and analyze something to the nth degree because you have to, even though you recognize that this project ought to move forward because of enough information indicating that it needs to be done. So the first thing is, my suggestion is that we do cost-benefit analysis. We understand the legislative intent or direction of making sure we continue to do it. We would suggest that not requiring it in every case would not be cost-effective in itself. The second piece is, there's a significant difference in terms of whether you're talking about preservation, modernization, bridge, what kind of work it is. And modernization is the one that offers the most opportunity for different kinds of factors and where you'd look at issues of social and other factors beyond just the straight economic area. Our concern is even applying those to modernization projects, you have a lot of variability of opinion about what those weighting factors are as you look at the decisions. So what we would suggest is we continue, and with legislative direction, we can make sure that we do emphasize this cost-benefit analysis work, but not to end up in a situation where we're requiring it in every single case, and that it's only one of the factors that's used in decision-making. So if the intent is to make sure that we're using cost-benefit analysis, we can salute and say we are, and make sure that it's part of the decision process used along with stakeholders to look at options that are out there and concerns that the citizenry have, but to make sure that it's moving ahead and moving a project forward with some logical judgment, because you're involving local government and state government decision makers in order to have them make decisions. And we can't think that throwing the numbers into a bin will result in the numbers coming out and dictating what should happen. I think you want to have good decision making done by local and state officials who are working together, looking at cost-benefit analysis as one piece of input, but are other pieces, and debating and discussing the weightings, but to also come up with a decision that relates to other inputs in the process.
Mike, could you go ahead? I understand we asked Joan to have you be prepared to address the study. Could you tell us about the study and what actually was recommended, and if any of those ideas have been implemented?
Mr. Chair, I can grab the study just for a moment, if that's all right.
All right.
The first thing I'd like to mention from the study and discussion is that the commission, in looking at the issue of cost-benefit analysis, was interested in pursuing it, the Oregon Transportation Commission, as a method of assisting in the process and having more of an official cost-benefit analysis approach used in every single project or in the majority of projects. As they went through the process, they found that the weighting of the variables was a significant problem in and of itself. And so the first concern was how you weight those and whether the preferences used by the OTC, the Oregon Transportation Commission, can be worked in a way that results in everybody agreeing with specific criteria, what they called in the study differing unconstrained criteria. In other words, there's criteria in the discussion that relates to several different factors: economic impact, environmental impact, community support, net present value. All those pieces are different elements of the discussion, and the concern was how we get to an agreement about those weightings. So that process is something that we'd work through. Right now we do technical analysis. It's one form of input, and it's brought in to the discussion to a group of stakeholders, local and state government officials, as a piece of information over which they can disagree and shift off of if they feel they have the information and facts to negate an opinion that's put into the weightings. And we don't put so much into these that it becomes a huge study like some states do. There's a significant amount of overhead placed into the process in some states, and the question is, what's your return on investment? Do you want to put so much into it when you have so much potential for debate about subjective variables? And that's the concern, I think, one of the pieces that comes out of the study. Another area of work is how to arrive at the consistent rankings themselves on a regional and statewide basis. You may be able to have something that comes up with a good evaluation of the criteria in Region 1 or Region 3 or Region 5, but then when you're trying to compare that across the state, looking at rural and urban concerns, there was a concern that maybe urban areas would end up with more projects because of the higher intense volume of number of vehicle miles traveled in that area, and therefore a potential of better return on the investment negates the needs for freight movement and citizen movement in rural areas.
But Mike, one of the purposes of this, and I understand the way it works in other states, is that if you get a community that says, hey, look, as for example, as when we were in Eugene, they said, we really need a flyover here, you know, just to the north of Beltline. We're willing to invest in it. Very similar to what Yamhill County, Polk County did on Highway 18 safety improvements.
Mm-hmm.
Which they said, hey, we'll match you. And in fact, I understand they put up almost all the money. But we don't want to have that happen where local jurisdictions haven't put up all the money. But my point is that their participation in this, saying this, we want this moved to a priority. We think this is economic and safety issue, and we're willing to invest in it. We saw the projects go forward, and that's the idea behind the bill, is that if other states are using a mechanism that enables a community to get invested in making that highway improvement occur, wouldn't that be a good thing? Tell me your experience, at least, with how other states deal with it, because I understand they use this to get buy-in and to move a project to completion and get construction.
Well, let me take – there are two questions there, Mr. Chair. The first one is relating to the local government involvement. Let me hit that one first. I think the Chair is exactly right. Looking at the state as a system, there are going to be times when a cost-benefit analysis or net present value analysis might say that the state of the system doesn't warrant this project in Eugene to compete well for a certain number of dollars. But if the local government is saying that they're willing to invest a certain amount, maybe past 50%, 80%, something like that, and then you're looking at a different amount in the statewide system, and instead of saying it's not worth it within the statewide system to put in $15 million on this, but if you put it $1 million for the benefit achieved, it makes more sense. And that's what we're doing now in working with local government is trying to evaluate that difference and be able to have that come into the calculation. I don't think we need to have a formal cost-benefit analysis to do that in every case. We can do that on the basis of looking at the criteria we have now in the pavement management system, bridge management system, as well as the safety system, and say, how do these calculations weigh, and making sure that we're looking at the amount of money that's necessary there. So my answer is yes, you're right. And secondly, I think we can do that now without having to go to a formal cost-benefit analysis that may require us to, as I said, emphasize more urban systems and statewide systems than the local ones. The second piece was what other states are doing. We have looked at other states and how they're working their cost-benefit analysis to some extent. The concern we have is I'm in another committee, Ways and Means, taking a major review right now that's saying reduce your overhead and administrative costs. And what we're trying to do is hit the balance that says where it looks like it makes the most sense, let's do cost-benefit analysis. Let's do the evaluation so that we have the information for decision-making, not in every single case, though. And if we get ourselves into a position where we're doing it in every single case, I think we're getting into a cost piece that does not give you the return on investment that you need as a decision-maker. We do have other states like Washington where they have put in 15 FTE into the evaluation process, 15 full-time equivalent positions, and a lot of money into systems that allow for full analysis of projects and full communication of a lot of different variables. We've evaluated that on our basis of decision-making, we would rather invest the money, as the chair says, in the pavement than to have as much that goes into the evaluation process of the different options, especially if we can get good information coming in from people and good teams of folks together to evaluate those alternatives. However, it really is the legislature that determines that, and if the direction is that you'd like to have that kind of analysis, we can do that.
Okay, I understand that we had a contact by a person who said that, and with the expertise to do it, that we'd be willing to analyze a project for about $5,000, and I think that's pretty amazing that he wouldn't be able to do that. But if we provided him basic information, it really would appear that you could go in and say, okay, you know, here's the cost, here's the benefit. Let's do analysis. Can we get a buy-in from the local group in a very simplified way? But we have a significant revenue expenditures projected here for this. Okay, we'll talk with you further because this is a framework bill, and I'd be really if you could provide for us. Do we have that detailed? Do we have your testimony dealing with specifically what are you doing currently that is parallel to the idea?
I have to give the chair a copy of the testimony.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair, I might mention just as leaving that our calculation on the fiscal impact was using about $5,000 per project as a way to look at that. So I don't think that estimate you got was all that far off of what you would find.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mike, thank you very much. We're still waiting for our committee to get here, so we're going to stay with this issue for a bit. Okay, let's have two of the top two come up to right now, if we could.
Mr. Chair, the next testifiers are Jacob Rostoff from 1,000 Friends of Oregon and Chris Hagerbomber from Oregon Environmental Council.
Jacob actually had to leave, so I have a testimony.
Okay. Chair George, Vice Chair Metzger, thanks for the opportunity to be here. My name is Chris Hagerbomber. I'm the Air and Transportation Program Director at the Oregon Environmental Council. We oppose Senate Bill 701 in its current form. And some of the points that I'm going to make here are similar to the ones that ODOT made in the sense that the criteria that are defined currently in the bill travel time savings generated, economic activity generated, and commerce facilitated are not going to work very well when you're comparing a preservation project to a modernization project, for example. They aren't going to work particularly well if you're comparing a capacity expansion project in a rural area compared to a metropolitan area. Obviously, you're going to generate greater travel time savings when you're dealing with a very congested system. So the metro area will win out, hands down, over the rural area. And I really question whether the state would want to abandon its obligation to maintaining a network of roads across the state. Another example.
Chris, since I represent a rural area, I can guarantee you it isn't going to go there.
Yeah. Another example, though, is safety, which is extremely difficult to quantify. A recent example is that issue where in Woodburn, the woman and her high school daughter were killed, and the response by the state, I believe, was to build a crosswalk there. Now, the type of cost-benefit analysis that we are talking about would not lead one to assume that one should put a crosswalk in when you're trying to facilitate faster travel. So it simply seems that cost-benefit tends to focus on very quantifiable benefits when there are many benefits that are extremely unquantifiable. We actually at the Oregon Environmental Council have long espoused the idea of a system that would be least social cost planning, where indeed you would look at the multiple costs and multiple benefits of any given transportation project, but those would include some external costs, like the cost of air pollution emitted, the cost to a community of having a highway run through and destroy homes, or the value of homes nearby that highway. And I just don't think that the type of analysis that we're talking about has been put together in order to be able to do those types of full costs and benefits, the full social costs and benefits. But my main argument against this bill is that ODOT is actually convening this STIP stakeholder committee. I think the first meeting is tomorrow morning, where they're going to discuss, actually their charge is basically to update the process of how the STIP is developed and the process in which you get stakeholder input. So they're going to be looking, this committee is going to be looking at this type of thing. How might cost-benefit analysis work in the STIP development structure? And at and numerous other issues of how the STIP is developed. And that's a really, you know, they're going to take several months. There'll be lots of input. And I'm worried that the legislative process is so time constricted that we wouldn't give this issue the full enough attention that the stakeholder committee would.
Chris, bear with me.
Sure.
You know, if you read the bill, you saw that we asked them to develop a model that generates a cost-benefit analysis, and we asked them to consider issues, just some issues that always seem to be get left out anymore, and that is the travel time. How much time are we spending? Do we need a capacity? Economic activity? What's been done? What has happened to my district in McMinnville because we don't have an adequate road? Jobs are leaving that area. The impact is amazing. And facilitate commerce. I mean, we need jobs. I mean, we're sitting here looking at an economic situation in collapse. So I hope you'll go back and look at the bill again, help us to develop a process. But I'm going to tell you, I think it's important because, believe me, somebody's going to mention 701 in that meeting tomorrow, and they're going to know that the legislature is wanting us to stop addressing ideas of landscaping and issues like that and get back to what makes this road system deliver people and commerce safely and on time. So go ahead and continue. I'm sorry about that. I preached my little sermon.
No, Chair George, I agree actually that those elements that you delineated in the bills obviously are ones that you need to look at when you're deciding what type of transportation improvements you're going to make. There are so many additional ones, and I don't think that we have time in this current legislative process to do a really good job of deciding what this should be in any given cost-benefit analysis. I do believe that we have time to do that in the STIP stakeholder process. So that's basically the conclusion of my testimony.
You are entitled to that opinion, and when you get to be a legislator, you can carry out your wishes. And so we appreciate your time. Okay.
Well,
yes. Oh, I'm sorry.
I think Chris raises some valid points, Mr. Chair, as you do as well. going through the STIP process, as you have in your district too, is that there are different STIP projects, and of course safety projects, as defined in this bill, economic activity, everything else, flow of traffic, for the most part, are the most minor of considerations for safety STIPs. You know, whether it be the Woodburn incident or a safety program improvement project on 282 that I have, or someone was killed on Highway 26, these particular cost analysis would not be severely relevant to any of my constituents for safety projects. But however, as the senator pointed out, you know, in terms of, you know, new construction or traffic flow, they would probably be extremely important. So I think there's value both ways in there, as to see how those go. And you know, personally, I'd be very anxious to see, you know, maybe some of the results of your work group on that, because, you know, the senator is certainly right in terms of when we invest especially significant dollars mm-hmm. to new construction or to improve traffic flow dollars and where those are going to go, as opposed to our safety improvement projects, which often are driven as much more by emotion of an incident rather than anything that we can quantify based on this type of analysis. So I think there needs to be some flexibility, but at the same standpoint, not focusing away from the fact that in many projects that cost benefit would be very appropriate. So thanks for your comments, too.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Chris. Andrea and John?
I better have to go to a meeting myself.
Yeah. Did I have to take police? We got one in the back there.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, once again, Andrea Fogg with the League of Oregon Cities.
And John Oshel with the Association of Oregon Counties.
Senate Bill 701, as it's before you. We, first of all, will say that the STIP is not a perfect process. There are lots of issues within the STIP that need to be clarified and looked at, et cetera. And as was just mentioned, there is a stakeholder group that is sitting down to talk about the STIP, the process, criteria, how the process can be clarified and improved. And we think that's a very important process. The League is participating in that process, as is the count, as are the counties. So we think that cost-benefit analysis is a very important criteria and should be one of the criteria considered within the STIP. Although it is an important criteria, we're concerned if it is given more weight than everything else. One thing that was mentioned is the fact that if you went on a pure cost-benefit analysis basis, you would have a situation where there are a lot of very good rural projects that just wouldn't be funded because on paper they don't necessarily weigh in terms of all of the benefits as compared with the cost. We think there are very important projects out there that do have merit that if it was purely a cost-benefit analysis would not get funded. So that is a concern, but again, we think it is important criteria and should be one of the criteria within the STIP process. Currently, ODOT does use certain cost-benefit analysis, as you heard, but certainly there may be ways to improve that. So that really concludes my comments, and I'll turn it over to John.
Senator George, Senator Metzger, John O'Shell, Association of the Oregon Counties again. My comments will be rather brief, frankly, because you've heard it already, so I don't need to take a lot of your time. The concerns part of what we have is, as Andrea mentioned, if you go with a straight dollars and cents cost analysis on any system, the lower volume routes fall off the table, and you end up, if you go purely with that you never, ever, ever spend money on them, and obviously logic says you can't do that. You have to have a system or it doesn't work. The other piece is, while totally agree that cost-benefit is a very, very important tool to use, there's times that it doesn't work well. The classics are when you've got two different programs with two different goals, what you assign for the assumptions in your benefits, radically different. It's, you know, you can come up with, for example, a pretty good cost-benefit analysis for which fish passage culverts you should do, but to try and do a cost analysis, and you can do a pretty good cost analysis for which guardrail projects need to be done, but to try and come up with an analysis that says whether it should be fish passage or guardrail, real hard to get there. The final one, and it was sort of covered a little bit with your comments, and the issues you're trying to get to is to say, hey, as part of the cost analysis, there is more than just the bottom line cost to the agency.
And you,
we think that is very important.
Even in the weakened form, the framework of the bill, it says that the model shall include but not be limited
correct.
To the following. This is a bill that opens up the portfolio and says at least we should recognize that travel time savings, the economic generation, that sort of thing should be. Certainly.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I just wanted to note two things very quickly, and that's that benefit cost analysis doesn't have, I've heard a lot of negativity about this concept today, and I think some of that can be addressed. I mean, benefit cost analysis can include, you can quantify safety improvements. I mean, that can be quantified. The value of life, for example, that can be quantified. And include and is quantified for benefit cost analysis for the FAA, for example. Safety improvements can be quantified, therefore. Environmental externalities can all be quantified and can be included in the model. And so to say that by including a benefit cost analysis, you're shutting all of these things that's not correct. And so you can weight it so that rural economic development could have a strong weight in the variables that are used in the benefit cost analysis. And this was just a framework that was knocked out so very rapidly. And so I just wanted to comment that things can be changed and the variables can be.
One thing,
if the chair is still a chair,
pause.
I'm going to lose. I want to move 47. I really do. We have a great bill here, and what I'd like to do is everybody save up their arguments, save up their debate, get in written statements to us, and with that, I'm going to close the subcommittee hearing. I'm sorry to be so rude here, you guys, on Senate Bill 701. And I'm going to, now that we have a quorum, I'm going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 47.
Mr. Chair, is my understanding the dash threes are the final amendments?
That is correct.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Chair, I move the dash three amendments to Senate Bill 47.
Okay, without objection.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 47 to the floor. It's a due pass.
Vice Chair Meskers moves Senate Bill 47 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further debate or concern or questions? All right. Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Carter, Senator Carno.
Aye.
Senator Meserly, Senator Meskers.
Aye.
Chair George.
Aye. Thank you, everyone. I will carry that bill. And with that, I think what I'm going to do, unless we have anyone who has a high level of heartburn, because I'm going to lose my two committee members and you just don't want to talk to me, I'm going to adjourn this meeting. And for anyone who's watching this on television, it must have been entertaining. With that, we'll be adjourned.
Thank you, Chair.
Yay!
Well, congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
My very quick comment to you is...
And I didn't even get to go see this screenshot.
You guys, didn't get me to finish that sentence.
Okay.
The thing I was discussing we heard today, you guys aren't going in person.
Yeah. Oh,
yeah, no. I mean, you know, when you read the bill, and it sounded like you were trying to come up with a rigid net concern. You didn't want to do
this. But,
yeah.
That
level of thing using
the that's sure. Yeah. That was knocked out 10 minutes before the deadline for submitted bills, quite frankly.
Literally.
And Joel, I think.
Didn't want to put my last statement at the hearing sounded like opposition.
No. I'll tell you, one of the things is that Joan did.